Morning, everybody. Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio in the historic Tribune Tower building. Roger Badish in the 7th floor newsroom for now. Jess Rains here behind the glass in the Showcase Studio. Raj, is this the last? Because I'm off next weekend at baseball. Is next weekend when you would be down here?
Yes.
And then from then on? Or is that the only time, and then you'll be over at the other building?
The sun, not this Sunday, but Sunday next week will be the last newscasts from this building. And at 2 o'clock Monday morning in 2 weeks, Vic Vaughn will be manning the news desk from the new location.
So at 2 o'clock Monday morning on
is that the 4th? I believe so, yes.
Because next weekend, like right now, would be Saturday, June 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be here. So Monday, June 4th, all the news starts from the new location. So this is our last time in the same building together.
Yes, it is.
Until we're in the same building together in the new building. This is our last time together in the old building.
In the iconic.
The historic.
The historic Chicago Tribune Tower.
Tribune Tower.
Yeah, I know. I've been thinking about it since we got the email, and it's rough.
And this is our last weekend getting to park here.
That's another
So next weekend, you're going to be here, but you ain't going to be parking here.
Yeah, I've already checked out places at the new place.
Okay.
In fact, after I'm done here tonight, I'm driving over there to reconnoiter.
Okay.
The locations, because I found three spots. Two of them, though, are accessible through the lower level of the roads over there.
Okay.
And one is the above level, so I got to figure out which is which.
Are any of them
some of the roads are one way.
Is there any street parking you found?
I haven't checked that yet.
Okay.
I need to check that for next weekend.
Let me tell you what I did when I got here tonight.
Are you supposed to tell anyone?
Well, I'm sure I will get in trouble if anybody finds out about this. So every week for the last 2 months, I would say, that we come in on a late Friday night, early Saturday morning, I park on the lower level behind the building. We have this open air. For those of you that don't know, haven't been downtown much lately, the Chicago the Tribune Tower, right here on Michigan Avenue with the Wrigley Building across the street, and where you walk up here on Michigan Avenue, this is actually an upper level. Everybody's always heard of Lower Wacker, but there is a Lower Michigan Avenue, too, on this stretch for about, five or six blocks here, right?
Yeah, easily.
From the river up north a little bit.
Yeah, if you look at the Michigan Avenue Bridge, if you're standing there and you see a lower section,
cars go across.
That's what we're talking about.
That's how you get to Lower Wacker from over here. But there's a Lower Michigan Avenue for a few blocks.
Right.
And so behind the Tribune Tower building, we have on a lower level an open air parking lot. That's where we all park. And we come in up the loading dock down there and exit and enter down there instead of the main entrance up here usually when we park down
there. For those who drive, sure.
And for the last few months, as we've been coming in and we walk along the loading dock, there's two huge dumpsters out there.
Right.
And usually guys working, making overtime. So you know the people that bought this building are serious about getting this thing
turned around. They've been doing that for
months and months, right? And they're dumping stuff and they're tearing stuff out and everything.
And each dumpster has a specific item. They don't dump everything into one dumpster. They separate it out.
There's like metals and like duct work and things like that.
Right. Everything's spread out.
There'll be all metal, and then I'll see like all drywall in another.
Right.
And
a
lot of times when I get here, they're actually power washing down the dock because they've been throwing drywall away all night, and it's dusty as all heck out there. And there's stuff in
the air. Not healthy. Yeah.
No. So all I've been thinking about all these every time I walk by, there's what floor is just ripped apart right now?
Yeah.
Something's just empty. So tonight, I got on the elevator, and I hit one to come up here, and it stops. And I look at the thing, and I think, let's just hit another floor. I hit 10, and I go up to 10, and I kind of peer my head out. It's all dark, and I just kind of look around the corners, and there's nobody there. And so immediately, I look up to see if there's cameras.
there are cameras up there.
There do not seem to be cameras.
Oh, no.
So I thought, all right, I dip my toe in the water, and I walk out. And I walk around, and unlike where we get out on our floor, everything is open. If you Tribune Tower security, not anybody can just walk in.
Right.
But if you do walk in and you get through and you take the elevator up and you get onto our floor, there's nothing blocking you from anything. It's wide open. You can walk around everything.
Right.
On this floor, when I got off the elevators,
on 10,
there is a door right away. You can't just walk into the hallway. You got to, there's doors. I thought, okay, well, this is going to be locked. It wasn't locked. So then I start walking around. And I'm looking out windows, and it's awesome.
Was it like all empty, torn out?
It's like somebody went bankrupt and just fled.
Oh,
there's some paper on the floor. There's still whiteboards on the wall, but mostly the furniture's all gone. There's a phone on the windowsill. On what, on, in one room, there were a couple of old copiers and a bunch of paper and like toner boxes.
Oh, my God. I wonder who had that floor.
I don't know. And then one, the big area was interesting. I'm assuming this is all still getting torn out.
Mm-hmm.
Was all like electrical work on the floor, like the tubes, the metal conduit that would carry the wires.
Yeah.
And I start tiptoeing into there. The lights are still on a sensor there. So all the lights turn on. And I freaked out and I ran out.
You're waiting for someone to jump out at
kinda, you. Kind of like, hey, what are you doing up here? Oh, my God. I'm so sorry.
Night security person with their little lunch bucket.
Yeah. I tried to hit one and I hit 10 and I didn't know where I was. And but I was able, it was really cool because, you know, on the side of the building, if you're by the river facing north and you look at the Tribune Tower building from there,
mm-hmm.
the historic, the iconic Chicago Tribune sign is there
right.
that they're now suing each other over, the new owners of the building and the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune Company. Are suing each other over whether they get to take those letters with or they get to stay. From the window there, I was able to look right down on those. And then behind there, it's kind of interesting how this is set up because, as we've talked about before, it's four buildings put together here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There was the Tribune plant that was here that was built in 1920. That is not the Tribune Tower. That is what is behind or east of the actual iconic Tribune Tower
right.
building. It's a like four-ish story building
mm-hmm.
that was the Tribune home for a few years. Then they had the contest. They selected the tower, and they built that basically right in front of or west of the original 1920
right.
building. So that's building number two, the tower that you know and love.
Mm-hmm.
Then building number three was the WGN radio building, which was added, I believe, in 1935.
Which is just north.
Just north, and it's only like four stories, and
right.
it's right now a Dylan's candy store, candy
mm-hmm.
shop. And then behind that, the fourth building that was attached, it was the WGN television building that was built like in the early 40s or 44, 49, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And that completed the four buildings, and they're all kind of just tied together.
Mm-hmm.
So in the middle, though, they don't all meet. There's like a space where you can look down between the four buildings. I believe that's where the fourth floor newsroom is, because I believe they have skylights in the newsroom, right? I think they did.
It's a very high ceiling there, very high, because it's actually two levels.
There's an
they have like upper
a
level you can
around.
Walk around.
Right.
Now, from that upper level to look up, I've never been up there, so I don't know if there's a skylight there.
I do know
that you can. Oh, I'm trying to think now, because I took a tour there with someone a number of years ago. And you know what? I think there's one more floor above that.
Before?
Yeah.
So, you know, all the buildings kind of look into each other, almost like a courtyard it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a ceiling and there's skylights for whatever's underneath it.
Okay.
But all these, you know, but I was looking down on all that. It was so cool.
Wow.
So before I'm out of here, I'm going to do a little more of that.
Now, were there still room dividers up, walls in that where you were? Or?
You know, it's interesting because this is such an old building. It's not big open space, right?
Right.
And so there's nooks and crannies you go into, and there's some big open areas.
Right.
And then there's some very small little areas of office space.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tight.
But they hadn't torn everything out yet.
Not everything,
okay.
but you could tell a lot had been torn out.
Gotcha.
On that floor. Like everything was kind of gone. The floor of this main area must have been ripped up, and now the conduit's still underneath that has to go and things like that. But it was kind of cool to see that and to be able to look out those
windows.
Are
you going to do another floor next week? Well, you're not here next week.
I'm going to do some more tonight, I think.
Okay.
And then in 2 weeks, until they take me out.
Well, you're only going to be here about another 3 weeks.
Well, that's the question. So if I miss next week, I'll have the week after that, we think for sure, right?
I think it's through the 14th, I think, something like that.
That's it?
Yeah.
Have they announced the last broadcast from the Showcase Studio yet?
No. But I think it's the middle of June is the end of it for the broadcast.
The 14th is a Thursday.
Maybe it's that weekend.
Oh, man. Well, so at least I'll still have the 8th into the 9th.
Yeah. I'll be in the other building, though. Yeah, you'll see me on TV still.
Yeah. Hopefully that works. You never know.
I've been told that it will.
Yeah, well, I tell you a lot of things.
Yeah.
Well, how do they know? I mean, something could go wrong.
Well, that's why that's Sunday. I'm gonna stay here for a little while, just in case.
When they do the flip?
Yeah, when they do the flip. Sense. If it doesn't flip properly, which I'm sure it will, then I'll be able to do a newscast here, and then they'll take it from there.
Flipped a switch at all yet? Have they done anything?
I'm sure they have. But have they done anything told me.
Nothing live on the air that you
But everything is like all digital. It's all, you know, microwaves and stuff. It's instantaneous.
Well, Aubrey was telling us last week when we talked to all the old producers that there's like five different backup systems.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Texter from 773 says, which is the floor that some say is haunted? I don't know that there's a particular floor.
You mean here?
Yeah, in the Tribune Tower. I know that there's been stories about the newsroom on the fourth floor. I made up a story when I first started on the air here with Kevin and tricked him into thinking there was a ghost on the seventh floor, which Legion Radio was. That was a fun night.
It was.
I don't know.
I never heard anything about the fourth floor, and I did weekend nights there. Sometimes it was just me and a couple of reporters.
Yeah.
But I don't – and I used to walk that whole floor in between newscasts. Mm-hmm. I would walk around just to see that because it's huge. It's so vast and so many different hallways to go down and walkways. And, oh, my goodness gracious, that place was huge. Yeah. So but I didn't see any ghost.
Well, maybe they just didn't want to see you.
Oh, wait a minute. What's wrong with me?
I'm just saying.
I'm ghost friendly.
It can be that way. All right. 312-981-7200. We have some exciting stuff on the show tonight, Roger.
We do.
There was a story about a week or two ago that I saw and I sent to Justin. I said, oh my gosh, we have to talk about this. There's a story that there's like 33 scientists that got together.
Uh-huh.
And they have released a study in which they say that octopi, now in the story they write octopuses. That is not correct, right?
It's octopi. Yeah.
Octopi, these scientists believe.
Oh, I saw this story.
Are aliens.
Yes.
Not of this earth. Octopi are aliens which evolved on another planet before arriving on Earth hundreds of millions of years ago as cryopreserved eggs via a process known as panspermia, according to radical new research.
Radical.
Octopi.
And you know, if you have seen Guardians of the Galaxy Part 2.
Haven't.
You
haven't?
Haven't
seen Part 1.
Jeez, you are so bad. After you've seen Part 1 and then see Part 2, there is a scene in there that would make that claim seem very real.
Okay. Interesting. Well, they look like they're aliens, right?
They do. They don't look like anything.
Or an octopus, it looks like, you know, something very different, like you see in a science fiction movie. We're going to take a quick break, and then I will tell you, while I haven't seen all your Marvel movies lately, I did go take the family to see Solo last night.
Ooh.
On Thursday night, actually. So I'll tell you what I think about it.
All right.
This, 312.
No spoilers.
No spoilers, but a couple very interesting things. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. Could octopi have come from another planet?
If so,
which planet did they come from? If they came from another planet, what else might have come from another planet? What if, Raj, we're all aliens?
I think so.
You think we are?
I think we're all bozos on this bus. It's an old comedy album.
It's a different take.
Yeah, I know. No. These are questions.
These are questions we'll answer with Peter Godfrey Smith, a professor in the School of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney. He wrote a book. He wrote a book a while back that was used by the guys that did this study. It was called Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness.
Ooh.
Now that's a 2:30 in the morning guest right there. All right, let's check the news headlines. Here is Roger Badish. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. Joining us on the phone right now is Peter Godfrey Smith. He's a professor in the School of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney, and he is the author of a book titled Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. Peter, thank you so much for joining us on the phone. We appreciate you being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. So I saw the headline a couple of weeks ago that a bunch of scientists are saying that octopi may have come from somewhere other than Earth. And I know that they some of the research was based a little bit or at least inspired by your book. Do you think it's possible that octopus, as we know them, are not of this Earth originally?
I don't think it's a serious possibility. I think octopuses are certainly from Earth. The guys who wrote that paper, they didn't make use of my book. In my book, I say that there's an important analogical sense in which we can think of octopuses as being akin to aliens, because although they are animals who evolved on Earth, they evolved in a way that involves a huge separation from us. Their last common ancestor, the ancestor that you most recently shared with an octopus, was an animal that lived about 600 million years ago. And that's a huge evolutionary distance with respect to animal life. And despite that, they're very behaviorally complex and, you know, in some ways quite smart animals. So meeting an octopus is in some ways like meeting an alien. But I don't think that they are literally aliens. And I don't agree with the reasoning in the paper that came out recently. I think it's pretty clearly a mistake.
And their reasoning, and I haven't read the whole thing, of course, but seems to be, from what I have read, that the octopi are so complex that they're not of this Earth, that they're so different than anything else we have here that it doesn't make sense that they evolved like everybody else did here. Is that kind of their basic gist?
There are two strands to it. One is the fact that they are just very unusual animals compared to other invertebrates. So they have larger nervous systems than other invertebrates. They've got brains and nervous systems that are roughly in the size range of vertebrate animals like ourselves. So that's unusual, and they are very behaviorally complex. The other thing that the authors of the paper drew on was the fact that they do have some quirks from a genetic point of view. So in 2015, the octopus genome was sequenced for the first time, and so there was a paper that wrote about some of the unusual genetic properties that they have. And one thing that this paper does is pick up on some of those peculiarities, but I have a completely different reading of that paper. I think that if you look at that paper, two things are clear. One is that they're very interesting animals genetically. They do have some distinctive features, but those features fit very naturally into place. They're roughly what you'd expect in an animal that's a mollusk, so it's got fairly close relatives who are animals like snails and oysters and clams. More distant relatives that include animals like us. The general profile of the octopus genome is not something, you know, outlandish, something that makes no sense given the general profile that animals have with respect to their genes. It's a sort of moderately unusual set of properties, and a set of properties that you could not have gotten if octopuses had evolved anywhere else. So if you think about, you know, just think about yourself and your siblings, a brother or a sister. You and your brother or you and your sister share a lot of genes. So if we look at samples from you and a brother, we can say, okay, these guys are very closely related. And what that means there is that you and your brother have a very recent common ancestor. Well, that you have two, perhaps, recent common ancestors, your mother and your father, and you and your brother are similar genetically because you inherited genes from that common stock. Now, when you look at animals that are very different from each other, so you and a dog or you and a fish or you and an octopus, the same kind of thing is true. You have a lot of genes in common with those animals, and you have those genes in common because you evolved from a common stock, although we have to go much, much further back in time to get to a common ancestor of you and the octopus. And I think that there's just no evidence that octopuses are outside of that general structure. I think octopuses do have common ancestors with you living here on Earth a long time ago.
All right. So if we go back far enough just about every living organism, can we track a common ancestor to all the living creatures on Earth?
That's right. It's an amazing fact. I mean, it's something that sort of just bears thinking about and imagining. And that applies to you and a dog, you and a fish, you and an octopus, even you and a blade of grass or a plant. All life on Earth evolved from a common stock. I mean, this was something that was not completely clear until fairly recently. It was a hypothesis that Darwin himself introduced back in the 19th century. It was part of his original formulation of the theory of evolution. And for a long while, it looked like a reasonable view, but perhaps not the only reasonable view. Perhaps life evolved separately a couple of times, and plants and animals perhaps were totally separate. That was, I think, a reasonable thing to wonder for a while. But now that we have a lot of information about the genetic properties of many animals and also many plants, it's clear that life on Earth does have a kind of unity, a kind of deep historical unity, such that you and the tree outside have a common ancestor if we go far back enough in time. Mm-hmm.
That is amazing to think about. And on some level, it does make sense that the Earth would have been created out of whatever, and so everything stems from that in some way, shape, or form. But then the question becomes, and in the review of your book that I was able to read from, reading about the idea of consciousness and how consciousness formed, and I guess then the big question becomes, if we all evolved from the same thing, if we go back billions and billions of years, why is it that humans have evolved to a level of consciousness and conversation and everything that we have, that we so dominate this planet out of all the different species that have evolved?
It is a remarkable set of facts, the set of facts about what humans have done and that no other species has done. Part of the point of my book is to think about the question, how many different kinds of animals are such that they do have experience of some kind. It feels like something to be those animals. They experience their lives rather than just sort of, plodding through them robotically. And octopuses are my main example of an animal that's very different from us and very historically removed from us, where we have, I think, good evidence to think it feels like something to be an octopus. I think they're sentient animals. I think, incidentally, the same is true of crabs, another interesting invertebrate case. And then you get to more difficult, more controversial cases among other invertebrates, even before you get to vertebrates. So I think the presence of a kind of sentience or a basic ability to experience things is widespread in animal life. And the next question, or one of the next questions one might ask is, why did it turn out that one particular primate species came to do such unusual things? Why did Homo sapiens come to, as you say, acquire such extraordinary power over what happens on the planet and power over the future of many other kinds of life on Earth? I have a little bit in my book about that. I think that one of the old answers that's given, which is the peculiar power of language as both a medium for communication and also as a medium for thinking, I think that's likely to be part of the answer about how humans got to be so distinctive. But I wouldn't want to suggest that those are questions that I have a lot of definite answers to. I think those are good questions.
Well, let me ask you a little deeper. So when you say feels like something to be an octopus or another animal, what does that mean? Do they have memory? Do they, understand things? Do they think about why they do certain things? All these things that we do that it seems that no other animal does. What level of sentience are we talking about?
Well, I think they certainly have memory. And memory is pretty widespread among animals. There are different kinds of memory. One of the interesting questions that's been asked in some recent papers about these and other animals is which animals have what's called episodic memory, which is memory of events, like when you remember your last birthday or something like that, or remember what happened yesterday, the kind of, internal movie-type memory. Lots of animals have memory, but probably don't have that sort of memory, which is the most vivid form of human memory. There's not been work on octopuses specifically that bears on that kind of memory, but there has been work on cuttlefish, which are fairly closely related to octopuses. And that work suggested that cuttlefish do have episodic memory or something like it. I mean, the paper said that they have episodic-like memory. The idea was that if you're a cuttlefish, which is looks a bit more like a squid than an octopus, you can remember particular things that have happened to you, such as whether you found food in this location on this particular occasion. And you can use that information to work out how to find food in the future. So memory is something which probably exists in very rich form in a surprisingly wide range of animals. One of the other things you mentioned is the kind of thought or cognition that's involved in a sort of reflection on events, where a human can sort of sit back and reflect on things that have happened and, you know, try to puzzle things out or try to understand them. That sort of reflective intellect is something which is probably a lot rarer. There's some work on birds that suggests that birds, some crows in particular, can sort of look at a problem and then do quite well at solving the problem without experimenting physically first. They can just sort of see a solution to a problem rather quickly. I don't think octopuses are likely to be able to do anything like that. Their way of dealing with things is through physical exploration, basically. They're very physically exploratory animals. So whereas certain kinds of birds, when presented with a novel situation, might sort of sit back and try to work out a solution to a problem, an octopus will sort of more likely just jump in there and start manipulating the thing, trying to sort of puzzle it out physically.
All right. So, but when we talk about them figuring things out, are we talking about a bird figuring out how to get through a hole because food is on the other side? To me, that wouldn't, I guess any animal, I would think, of course, there's a survival instinct that we wouldn't necessarily relate to consciousness. Do any animals sit back and reflect on, I don't like that other bird, I'm not going to hang around with that bird anymore? Think, you know what I mean? Like things that are a little more upper level, where it's not just this is survival based, this is more thinking about why and how we do things. Or am I looking at it completely wrong, and maybe everything we do still can be distilled down to survival instinct in some way, and maybe we're not as complex as I'm giving us credit for?
I think we're very complex. I wouldn't be trying to sort of deflate or downgrade the apparent complexities of humans. In the bird case, I mean, the work I'm thinking of is work that involves the use of tools by birds. So the birds in question, probably the most impressive birds in this area, are a certain kind of crow from New Caledonia in the Pacific. And there's now a lot of experiments in which these birds are able to look at a situation and work out that a particular kind of piece of bent wire will enable them to, you know, get through an obstacle or solve a problem or get to food that they couldn't otherwise get to. And they will pretty spontaneously bend pieces of wire to make a tool of the right kind. So we're not talking just about a bird, you know, looking at a maze or a physical problem that requires the bird to mess around with it. The bird is doing something pretty impressive, making a tool and putting that tool to use. You mentioned social intelligence, the sort of thing where an animal might think, you know, I don't like this guy, I do like that guy. Mm-hmm. This is certainly an area where primates and also some birds and dolphins do seem quite sophisticated. There's a very good book about social intelligence by Cheney and Safar called Baboon Metaphysics, which I write a bit about in my own book. And the impression one gets from the more we learn about the social life of primates like baboons is that it's a soap opera. There's this incredibly complicated, often rather vexed and difficult set of social interactions that the animals are dealing with. And it involves a lot of tracking of individuals, working out, you know, this guy is being good to me, this guy is not. This guy I don't like, but he's an ally of this other one. So I've got to deal with two rather than one individuals if I choose to make trouble. That sort of social intellect is widespread in animals like primates, and it's fairly likely that some of the unique evolutionary processes that gave rise to human intelligence involve the complexities and pressures of that kind of social living.
Okay, so then is it reasonable to think that, since I would assume evolution is a continuous thing and will still evolve and all the creatures on Earth will still evolve, is it reasonable to think that maybe a billion years from now we won't be the only creatures on this planet, assuming we can survive that much longer, that have the level of consciousness that we have?
I think anyone who tries to say anything about that question with a lot of confidence is doesn't have much justification. It's so hard to work out what's likely to happen, I think, even in the near future. I mean, one of the provisos you mentioned is whether we survive and whether we succeed in not messing up the planet so much that nothing complex can survive. I think those are quite big provisos. I think there's a fair chance that we will mess things up very badly for complex forms of life like ourselves. If we don't, then, I have no idea. People often wonder whether octopuses and other cephalopods might, in principle, evolve more complexity and a more conspicuous role in shaping the future of the Earth. I don't think, I think if they were to do that, they would have to change themselves in quite substantial ways. One of the surprising things about octopuses and other cephalopods is they're very short-lived animals. Octopuses generally live just for 1 to 2 years. And 2 years is quite a long lifetime for many octopus species. So despite being very behaviorally complex, they rush through their lives. They're also a lot less social than we are. So the particular advantages that humans get from their complex forms of social living are some way away from cephalopods and many other animals. But we can imagine pathways, I think, by which, given enough time, some of these things would change.
Are there any species that seem to have the physical attributes that would allow a higher form of consciousness, or is that going to require much more evolution for other species to have the brain power or the ability to vocalize that maybe would be required to catch up to us?
I don't know a great deal about dolphins, but the more I learn, the more impressed I am by them and amazed, really, at the kind of complexity they have. Dolphins would be, it's a fairly standard candidate, but I think a good candidate for an animal that might have a huge amount going on inside that we really barely have an inkling of. So that would be one candidate. There was a book by Carl Safina. He's written a number of books in this area where he explores a range of interesting candidates for animals that might have a great deal going on inside them. Wolves, he talks about, orcas or killer whales are another example, and elephants, another animal that I've only just begun to learn a bit about. They also may have a great deal going on inside them, stuff that we have barely an inkling of.
The book is called The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. Peter Godfrey Smith, a professor in the School of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney, has struck down the idea of octopi coming from another planet, but has given us a lot to think about. I really appreciate you jumping on the phone tonight, Peter.
It's been a pleasure.
I hope we talk again soon. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend. That's fascinating. All right, we got to take a quick break. Then we got the news next, 720 WGN.
It's my house. Come on, turn it up. Hear a knock on the door and the night begins.
You know why, Jess? Alien. Matt Pabala with you, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. I really enjoyed Peter Godfrey Smith.
He was very cool.
I mean, I'm bummed that right away, boom, first question out of the gates. No, they're not aliens.
Yeah.
He kind of just poo-pooed the whole thing.
But they share.
We are all, and how about that?
Yeah.
He says that if you go back far enough, we're all ancestors. Every living thing, you and I and a blade of grass, ancestors.
Yeah,
What's up, cuz?
I agree with that.
See? Barbecue mm-hmm. just got a lot bigger this Monday, didn't it?
That's right.
Everybody.
Bring your own.
How good
BYOB.
Would it, how great would it be?
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of theories on the world here.
Right.
One is, I wonder what would happen if the existence of God mm-hmm. was completely proven.
That would be
that
cool.
That we all accepted. That, wow, this was the creator, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care whose religion it falls under in mm-hmm. the end. My guess is
the
he'd say none of them.
Known as God. Yeah.
The creator sure. is revealed, and mm-hmm. we all know it to be fact and true.
That would be mind-blowing.
What would that do to the earth? Would we then all come together and go, wow, let's drop all the pretense about this religion's the best whatever and just live as one? I've actually wondered that more about just if we found alien life. Mm-hmm. If suddenly we were contacted by another world, would that help us come together or would it tear us further apart? I don't know the answer to that.
I don't think it would bring us together.
Okay. What if we found out that we were all interrelated? Because I think that while all human beings mm-hmm. are related in some way, of course, mm-hmm. we look at each other as completely different.
That's right.
Whether that's different colors of the skin, different religions, different nationalities. We act like we all came from 8 million different places when really this one rock that we're all part of, mm-hmm. you know, we all came from in some way, right?
Right.
And so it's fascinating and not, I guess, surprising to think that all life evolved from the same place. That makes sense.
Sure.
As he said, it also made sense at the time to think that different types of life evolved differently. But he made it sound like now science would tell us that you go back far enough, we all come from the same place.
And here's another possibility, that where life began in one place, it could be that life began at the same time in several places, which may give rise to some questions of how certain...
we all look so different.
Not so different necessarily, mm-hmm. but how civilization began in some areas and not others.
Mm.
And how it appears as though there were several civilizations developing at the same time around the globe. They didn't like start in one spot and say, I got a plane ticket to the other side of the planet. I think I like the country there better. I'll see you later, cuz. I think that life began in various spots on our planet all at the same time, and that people stayed there but then started to travel. And that's how you had people eventually ending up in other parts of the world.
Well, we don't know.
No.
I don't know if we'll ever know. But it is curious to me that why are we the only ones with this level of consciousness? Why do
right.
we dominate the planet?
Right.
Now, some might say because God created it that way. So maybe that is it. And maybe it's not. I don't know. Through evolution, will eventually another species have the intelligence we have? And then how will we look at the world? I mean, think about it. If we think of how if there was consciousness among the other species, how would they look at us? They would look at us as these awful terrorists, right?
You mean another species developed on our planet?
Well, if all the other species that are currently on the planet,
mm-hmm.
all the animals that we know, if they attained our level of consciousness, we eat them, we put them in zoos,
right?
We cut them up and study them for science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about that.
If all of a sudden they had the
really
same
awful.
Consciousness and abilities, mental abilities and reasoning as we do,
they'd be scared to death of us.
I don't know.
Oh, Roger.
I don't think
Roger.
They would be scared of us.
Why not?
I think they would attack us.
Well, they don't have... You just said...
Of all the reasons...
All you said was they had mental abilities and consciousness now. They don't have, you know, AR-15s.
Well, no, but they have
the
other
bomb.
Abilities.
Oh.
I mean, excuse me.
Are they building a factory now?
Excuse me. Let's go back to your octopi. Octopi are able to squeeze through extremely thin openings.
Think about these huge octopi
outside of water.
These huge octopi
yes.
that can fit through something the width of their eye.
The bottom of your doorway. Seriously.
That's crazy.
I've seen it too.
There was a viral video earlier this year on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing just like, there was a little like crack in the side of the boat.
Right out. Yep.
Slid out. That's crazy.
And then you wake up with one on your face.
If you are with an octopi or an octopus and you kind of put your hand out and your finger out, one of their tentacles will come out and like touch your hand. There's a story about a guy he went swimming with, and an octopi came up and like took his hand and led him to his den and showed him where he lived.
That's pretty wild.
But still, they're not, you know, they're not building factories and making cars. So
they don't need to.
Simple
lives.
Let's stop with they're going to attack us. First, before they figure out how to do that, they're going to look at us.
I think they already know.
They're going to look at us and go, those people are evil. They kill us. They eat us.
Right.
They dump their trash in our homes.
Yeah.
We look really bad.
Yep.
Could you still be? So I'm a meat eater. I eat steak. You know, I like eggs. You know, all the things that animals make that we eat, I take part in. I don't like seafood, so I guess the octopi would like me, although I do eat calamari.
Oh, you're in trouble now.
I didn't think of that. but if suddenly those animals had consciousness, could communicate with us, we wouldn't be I would assume we'd kind of stop eating animals, right? Wouldn't we all kind of go vegetarian? For the most part, I know there's a lot of people that would, we're more powerful than them, blah, blah, blah. But if they could talk to us, if we equated them more personally, you know.
I don't think so.
Horse meat used to be very popular. People used to eat horse meat. I was just, you know what, I'm rewatching Mad.
I think there's still some people in the world who do eat
horse
meat.
I'm sure in some parts of the world you eat what you can get.
That's right.
On an episode of Mad Men I was watching recently, because I'm rewatching the series and loving it again, there was a old acquaintance who comes back to the agency bringing her business back, and she's going through a terrible time because her family's dog food brand, which is made of horse meat, has been called out, and there's a public outcry, and she's like, it's all made of horse meat, everybody's brand is made of horse meat, but our name has been tarnished by this.
Right.
And I was thinking, man, and think about that. We would never eat dog, we would never eat horse meat now for the most part, right? There's certain things that, because we have developed an affinity for those animals, we don't look at them as meat.
Right.
If cows were more cute and cuddly, we'd be eating those steaks, right? I mean, we wouldn't.
That's right.
And so if there was a consciousness and a communication between the species, we'd stop and think, well, I can't do that in good conscience, right?
Yeah. You know what? You bring this up and all of a sudden a thought pops into my head. Yeah, we still have to. Thank you so much.
I wouldn't have the sausage on it.
No, you wouldn't. I wouldn't have pepperoni. Where is pepperoni? Pepperoni's, it's got meat in it.
Yeah, it's from probably mostly pig, right?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. But it's so good. So as you're saying that, what comes to mind is a kid on a farm who, you know, a lot of cattle there. And the kid picks one of the young cattle and raises the cattle, beefs it up real good and loves it and everything. And then at some point when the cow matures and is prime for the sale, takes it to a state fair, county fair, and sells it. They do this. You know, they sell cattle and sheep and pigs at these county fairs. I can't even imagine the emotional distraught that this child goes through, knowing that it's not just being sold to be put to pasture like a horse race or like a horse from the Kentucky Derby, but is will end up in a slaughterhouse and end up on someone's plate as a piece of meat.
We should ask Orion about that. My guess would be that when you grow up with something from the get-go and this is how things are, then you get accustomed to that.
Yeah,
that is how life always was on the farm.
I understand that, but again, you know,
it's
you're
be
talking about dogs and cats and horses, and we've grown accustomed to having them as pets as opposed to food. And the child on the farm is raising that. I don't know. It just hit me in the head when you said that.
Roger,
now I'm going to stay up all day long.
I'm going to tell you how the world works. And it's as
simple. Please, Dad.
It's as simple as this.
Yes, Dad.
You take the good. You take the bad.
Yeah. So it sounds like a TV show theme song.
You take them both.
Yeah.
And there you have.
Yeah. facts of life.
The facts of life.
Thank you, Dad.
And that's how it is. Kids grow up on the farm. This is how things work. And I think they're just very realistic at an early age of, we'll ask Orion about this when we get a chance to check in with him later. Because I imagine it is very tough for kids the first time. Look, Charlotte's Web.
Mm-hmm.
How do you not cry when you read that book?
That's right. That's, yeah. See?
Is what it is.
Wow.
312-981-7200. Our friend Glenn has called in. Good morning, Glenn. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Yourself?
We're good.
I'm just thinking, how pompous would it be for us to think that we're the only creatures to have a consciousness and or self-worth, only because that we're not able to talk with other animals or
it depends on how we're defining things, Glenn. I think science would tell us we are the only creatures who communicate in the same ways that we do, who think about things in the way that we do, who, you know, we're the only creatures that have jobs and build buildings and do all of these other things that we do. So there is a level of consciousness that we have that nobody else carries around. But there are very complex beings with feelings and no pain and emotion, but it's we can't equate it exactly to where humans are.
No, it's been proven that octopuses have the ability to reason, where they've taken experiment and put a food source and put it in a jar, and they're able to open the lid to get to that food source.
See, now to me, Glenn, that doesn't tell me much. I don't believe, because if it's food related, then it's food related. That's survival. That's a skill that any animal would learn. Like we learned, I'm sure, our ancestors and things like that. I think that that's just something they learned. What I want to see, you're going to tell me, hey, octopi have this consciousness. You show me an octopi and a mother-in-law having a fight and then an octopi storming out. To me, that's like, wow, they're just like people. Those are the types of relationships and complex emotions that we have that I don't think that the other species on this planet have gotten to yet.
Well, I don't know. You also think that the only two creatures on this planet that fight for the sake of fighting are humans and ants.
That's interesting. Ants fight for the sake of fighting?
Yeah, they war against themselves, just like humans do.
Hmm.
And they're the only two creatures on this planet that do that.
Seriously? That's wild. What about like packs of wolves and things like that?
Well, it goes back to eating. So, survival of the fittest.
Don't you think that
everything? I think everything has its own consciousness. Some are just more elevated to different levels.
I'm not saying nobody else has consciousness at all. I know they have feelings and they have emotions, but they're not the complexity of ours. Why do we have buildings and cars and travel to other worlds and actually think about things like that? That we sit here and think, why?
Yeah, I know.
I don't know if
because we like possessions.
Well, all right, sure, that's some of it. But Glenn, that I would be sitting here talking about why did we evolve? Why are we these people? And what does it mean? I don't think anybody else, any other species, sits around and does that. So how did we get here and why?
It's just a fluke of nature. Who knows?
That's the question.
It's just one big crapshoot.
Well, I think that's very much a possibility. There's also a possibility that there was a create. And listen, I'd go with the crapshoot. It's just random. Science gets us all the way back to the Big Bang, but then doesn't explain why there was a Big Bang or what was before the Big Bang.
Well, what was there before the Big Bang? Or was there a Big Bang before the Big Bang? Is this a cycle thing? Was there a Big Bang and then everything came back together? Then there was another Big Bang? Who knows?
Hmm.
Those
are the questions that remain unanswered. But I tell you what, there's no octopi under the sea on a 50,000-watt radio station blowing bubbles through the water talking about this. It's just you and I, bud.
Hell no.
All right, Glenn. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much for checking in. 312-981.
Glug, 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 glug.
Yeah, that's how that would go, actually. The signal just doesn't carry water.
No. Travel slower
in
water,
I'm sure. They got 8 fingers. They can dial it fast. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. There's a party on the rooftop, top of the world. can we get on the Tribune Tower roof? What floor is that, Roger? What floor is the
You know, I've never been up there, but I know people have been up there.
All of our GN family go up there all the time because they're here during the week, during the day.
Right.
We're not.
No, I know. I have no clue.
Just look up what floor the Twin Tower deck is on.
You didn't hear that, ladies and gentlemen.
Nope.
Nice pictures.
Thank you. So if you like my Facebook page, go to Facebook.com, like the Matt Bubala Show.
Mm-hmm.
I just posted during Roger's newscast at 3. I ran back up to the 10th floor and I took some pictures. And I
what's this one where it's like the lights are glaring right in the window? That's the river shot. Those are the lights down on the street that are illuminating the building.
I think maybe the lights had gone on in the room too and were reflecting. Is there a reflection of me? I should.
There's a reflection on both ways, but the ones on the street kind of do it. But I do see you.
But you can see these big empty rooms, and that I don't know who was on the 10th floor, but the entire floor was a raised floor, like we have in engineering.
I can see that. Yeah,
and they still have all the conduit all over the place. Yeah. So I'd be careful walking around.
I would, but there's a ghost in this building.
Where?
I see the, well, in all your pictures, I see an image of a shadowy figure.
That'd be me.
Oh, sorry.
I was going quick. I couldn't set up the shots perfectly. I'm afraid somebody's going to walk in at any moment and bust me. I want to get in trouble. 312-981-7200. Go to Facebook.com, like the Matt Bubala Show, and see some of our urban exploring of our ancestral home before we vacate it for good. 3:30 in the morning, watch Micah and Joe, that's Micah Matera and Joe Donlin, weeknights on WGN-TV News at 5, 6, 9, and 10. 3:30 in the morning. Let's get some headlines, Roger Battis. Morning, everybody. 3:37 in the morning, to be exact. Matt Bubala with you. 7:20. WGN. Jess Rains is here producing. She's behind the glass. When you dial 312-981-7200, she will pick up the phone and say, hello, WGN Radio. Is that what you say, Jess? I have no idea what you actually say when you answer the phone because I've never called you because I've been here.
I say, thanks for calling WGN, or sometimes I say WGN Radio.
I like both. Roger Battis is in the 7th floor newsroom for the final weekend.
Yeah.
Next weekend, the WGN newsroom will be torn apart. He will be down here in the showcase studio. I will be away.
Correct.
Boys are playing a tournament in Cooperstown, New York.
Ooh.
We're heading for an entire
nice place.
God help me, yes. New York State.
You know how I'd answer the phone?
How would you answer the phone, Roger?
What do you want?
That's not the proper way to do it.
That wouldn't be the right way?
No.
All right, I'll take lessons from Jess.
Please do.
Okay.
So at 4 in the morning, I'm going to see if I can get the 25th floor is where the observation deck is. Now, last time I tried to do this with one of my former producers years ago, with Caitlin Fry.
Oh, yeah.
It was locked. We couldn't get out there.
It was all locked up.
It was.
But that was several
years. But that was
years
ago. And now they're tearing the whole place apart. So maybe, maybe things are just unlocked.
Maybe all the doors are wide open.
Together? Well, yeah, that's how it was on the 10th floor.
Everything was open.
It was interesting. I really want to find out what was on the 10th floor because they had the lifted floor.
Oh, and they won't have the directory wouldn't be up. Well, I don't know because, you know, CNN's been gone for a long time, but on our directory on this floor,
still says CNN.
It still says CNN.
There was no directory. Everything was taken off the walls and stuff
on the
like
hallways.
That. I was trying to figure out who it was. There were some, like, books left behind and stuff, but I couldn't figure out who it was.
Mm.
But it was interesting. Why would they have this fake floor? I guess maybe if they had cubicles, they needed electricity everywhere. So maybe that just
And they
makes
wouldn't
sense.
Want to trip over all the cables and stuff. So they put in a false floor so the floor would be smooth to walk on.
Yeah. So maybe that's
I
just
can
what
understand
it was.
That.
Could have been anybody, I guess. But the interesting thing is on this 10th floor, they had a ton of series of little lockers, like really thin little lockers that people could maybe open up and hang a coat in or something.
Yeah.
But there were like 50 or 60 of them. So I thought that was weird.
Wonder what that...
But it was... It
wasn't a health club up there.
That's what I thought at first, but that doesn't make any sense, and I don't think it was that, because we never had a health club upstairs. It was in the basement.
No, there's something, in the basement, there's
is
exercise.
Is that still open? Do they still have
I
that
don't
place,
know.
Or is that shut down yet?
I have no idea. But for all the years, you've been here a lot longer in total years than I have.
Mm-hmm.
I've been here about 11 and a half years now.
Mm-hmm. I've been knocking around since 97.
Yeah. And you worked a lot during the day.
Yes.
So... you may have had more chance to walk around the building.
I never did.
Well, see, and that I
hate
don't that. Either. I, you know, the newscast come every, 30 minutes,
right.
And I'm doing other stuff up here, and sometimes with hosts like you, where you welcome me into your family, and we talk,
right.
a lot.
You don't,
I don't
just go walk around.
Yeah, I can't just walk around.
You can't pull a bird train, do a cast, and walk away for half an hour.
Yeah, really? Sorry, Steve.
So at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to go do a little more urban exploring.
All right.
And we'll see what I can get. And just have the bail money ready. At after the 4 o'clock news, a new book about D.B. Cooper. Now, if you're a fan of the show, if you're a listener of the show, you know that we have spoken to guys who put together a cold case team, and they think they found the guy. They think he's still living in San Diego. And they are convinced. Publishing company in Grand Rapids says it was a guy in Michigan who died. So we'll talk to them, figure out their theory. And what do they think about the San Diego theory? And will this ever be solved? We'll find that out. So I went and saw Solo. Took the whole family.
That's right.
We went Thursday night, the 9:30 showing. And this is the origin story, so to speak, of Han Solo. It's a young actor, an unknown actor playing Han Solo. We find out, you know, I'm not going to give away a bunch of stuff on it, but the basic gist that you, if you've seen any trailers, we find out kind of how he first came in contact with the ship, the Millennium Falcon. We find out how he first meets Chewbacca. We find out how he first meets Lando Calrissian. And it's a great kind of, it's a really good adventure story. You know, there's backstabbing and intrigue and all of these things. I did enjoy it. It's not my it's probably not my favorite Star Wars movie of all time. I do think, and Michael Phillips gave it a pretty good review. I was surprised at how good a review actually that Michael Phillips gave it. But I do think sometimes they try to pack too much action into these movies instead of allowing the characters to develop and have interactions more.
Well, they have to outdo the last one.
And,
you know, and it's an action movie.
I don't think they have to do that. And I think they could spend a little less time doing that and a little more on the characters, because they introduce some really great characters a lot of times that we just don't get to see enough of. And so I would have liked to have seen a little more. Two things that they do in the movie that I loved. So if you're a Star Wars fan, if you're a big Star Wars fan, you know that there's always been a big thing about in the original Star Wars when Luke and Obi-Wan Kenobi meet Han Solo for the first time, because they need passage to the Alderaan system, and they need to avoid any Imperial incursions. So they're going to hire the captain of the Millennium Falcon.
And they meet him in a bar.
They meet him in the cantina.
Yeah.
And you've never seen a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. And they say, "Do you have a ship that can get us there?" And he said, "You haven't heard of the Millennium Falcon?
Don't tell me they make the Castle Run."
They're like, "No, should I? I'm not going to tell you that." But he says, he says to him, "It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs.
Yeah.
And like, what the hell is that? What?
Yeah, nobody cared.
Well, but the interesting thing was, we find out later, or people think about and talk about that, that didn't make any sense. He made the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs. A parsec is not a unit of time. It's a measurement. It's a distance, right? I believe is what we've always been told. This was kind of a flaw in this whole whatever. They deal with that brilliantly. And we can no longer say that doesn't make any sense. They literally solve that. And it's brilliant.
Does Bill Nye come on and explain it scientifically?
He doesn't. He doesn't.
No?
and I will say this. I don't know when they wrote the original script if they knew they were making a mistake and said, no, no, it's not a mistake, or if that was just like once they went back, like, oh, I guess that doesn't make so much sense, or if they knew all along what they were doing. But they fix it.
Well, I think when they made the first, when they wrote that script, that was the first Star Wars movie that came out. I don't think they had any clue at that time that someone would come up with an idea and say, hey, let's go back in time.
I'm sure they did.
And show the origins of...
No, but I think that, you know, maybe George Lucas had in his head what the Kessel Run actually was and how it worked. It's possible.
Parsec, a unit of distance used in astronomy equal to about 3.26 light years.
Wow.
One parsec corresponds to the distance at which the mean radius of the Earth's orbit subtends an angle of 1 second of arc.
Just so you all know, if you go see the movie, you won't have to hear boring conversation like that. Chewbacca and Han don't debate this. And one other thing. Also from the original movie, there is a scene still in the cantina right after that scene with the 12 parsecs. A bounty hunter finds Han. Because Han is wanted by Jabba the Hutt.
That's right.
And his name is Greedo. And in the original movie, when you saw it, Greedo comes to the table and sits down. He's pointing a blaster at Han Solo. And Han sits back and says, Greedo, I was just coming to see Jabba. I've got his money. I'm blah, 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 blah.
Well, too late for you, Solo. I found you and there's a bounty in your head.
And then Han is leaning back and he's kind of scratching the wall behind him. But meanwhile, he's got his hand under the table. He's undoing his blaster.
Right.
And in the original movie, Han shoots Greedo dead.
That's right.
But when George Lucas redid the movies for their re-release, he has Greedo shoot first from a foot away and miss.
Right.
Which makes no sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the worst bounty hunter in the world? The guy that was sitting across the table and missed.
Yeah.
Which, so that makes no sense.
And there was still a debate who shot first.
Well, I don't know if there's a debate. Apparently George Lucas made it Greedo shooting first, even though in the original movie, Greedo doesn't shoot. And that, I don't know. I never read about if George Lucas said, well, that was a mistake. He was supposed to shoot and I fixed it. He always shot first. It just didn't turn out right. I don't know. I don't know what the story is on why he did that or if he thought that made Han a bad guy, that Han would shoot first. I don't know. But for whatever reason, it came back that Greedo shot. And so there's always been a Han shot first kind of mantra among Star Wars fans.
Mm-hmm.
They deal with that. In essence, they deal with it, but they don't like finish it off with Han saying, sometimes you got to shoot first.
Right.
The character should have said that in the movie. I swear to God, the theater would have erupted in applause if at the moment he has the opportunity,
man.
He would have said, sometimes you got to shoot first. I wish he would have said that. I think they really missed an opportunity for a great laugh in the film.
Yeah.
And I'm curious because, you know, there were these two directors that were directing the film, and then they got fired, I think, about halfway through production. For creative differences with the boss, Kathleen Kennedy, who was from Lucasfilm, who still runs the company now that it's under Disney.
Right.
So they fired them, and Ron Howard came in and shot the rest of the movie and fixed whatever, and this ended up being his movie.
And there was concern by aficionados before there were any trailers or anything that he was going to ruin the movie. Because how could Opie make a Star Wars movie?
Well, Ron Howard is an incredibly accomplished director.
Yes.
But I could see where people would think, well, is this going to get a little bland now? You got these two young guns that are creating this movie. It's going to be edgy and whatever. And now, you know, what exactly is going to happen? It still turns out is a really good movie. Okay. I'd love to know the details on where was it headed and how would it have been different had these two guys remained at the helm and seen it through to completion.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's got laughs. It's got a lot of action. And it's got some really good characters and some really good storylines that I wish they could have just given a little more time to and a little less on the action.
Yeah.
And they set it up for the next movie, the next solo movie. I don't know if that's great or not. And I don't know if
they're trying to start a franchise. And now every character is going. I just saw a headline tonight in like Newsweek or something. Right. And now they're also saying, all right, now who in the solo movie will get their own movie?
Well,
and Lando could get his own.
Lando could get his own movie because he's a good character in this. Donald Glover plays him really well.
Yeah.
And so that's a possibility. Boba Fett's been announced for the movie. There is going to be a saturation point here. They can't start doing two Star Wars movies a year because we just had one in December.
And we've got another one coming up. We got to get one next year. The number nine.
But is nine when coming is number out nine? This December or next December?
Oh.
I don't know. I don't know.
I think it's I'll have to look. You want me to look it up? I'll look it up.
We can.
Okay.
And that's what I'm a little worried about, is that they're going to start doing too many of these. Because this one is tracking, I think, for the lowest release.
2019.
So that's it till, is it December 2019 or are they all in May now?
December 20th, 2019, Star Wars Episode 9.
So we have a year and a half now then till the next movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a long time.
Yeah.
I like one of
But they're going to come out with
I don't
with
know why they
stuff.
Didn't save this one till Christmas then.
Well, who knows what else they're coming out with?
Well,
plus, I don't know. They might come out with another one. They might find, like, Rogue One took place with a specific event.
Right.
You know, there's no backstory on there. The backstory was announced in the Star Wars movie. And so they went and filmed the backstory.
Right.
And that was it. It's a one-off, and that's it, you know. Maybe there's other things in the Star Wars pantheon where they can pull
something.
Well,
we would know, though, if there was something coming out this December.
Because it would have been in near in post. We'd see the trailers by now. I don't know what else would be going on, though.
I think Episode 9 is the next one.
Yeah, all right.
I'm pretty sure of that. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I'm pretty sure of that.
Okay. I just got to get out and see movies before they come to the... I keep not waiting for them to come onto Amazon.
Yeah, that takes too long. Sometimes you got to get out to the theater. Right?
I know. And I have all the best intentions, but then the curmudgeon, grumpy old man comes out and says, I can't stand movie theaters anymore.
Yeah, the next one is Episode 9, December 2019. There's a Boba Fett movie rumored for 2020. There's a new Star Wars trilogy rumored for 2021. That's supposed to be just a completely new set of characters, I think, unrelated to the one.
In another part of the galaxy. It's supposed to have nothing to do with the 9 movies.
Right.
Just a whole completely different place and time.
So that will be interesting.
Yeah, I heard about that.
And there's always been rumors about an Obi-Wan movie, and Ewan McGregor supposedly still wanted to play him.
They kind of did a little bit of the backstory in 1, 2, and 3.
They did. But he didn't get a standalone.
No.
Which maybe he still will. Maybe he still will.
But, you know, they could do a movie about the time he disappeared, because remember he...
He goes into
hiding.
Becomes a hermit and watches Luke growing up.
Yeah.
They could also do something from earlier than that. They could do something from before he was raising Anakin, or just an adventure on his own, or who knows what.
Yeah.
They could do a Darth Maul movie. I think that would be interesting to see. No, I love Darth Maul.
Yeah, just a little too much on the makeup for me.
Could do a Darth Vader movie. I mean, all you need is James Earl Jones to still do the voice.
We saw that.
We saw him become Darth Vader.
Yeah, we saw that was the backstory.
Well, we go from him being Darth Vader being created to Luke Skywalker. So you got about 17, 18, 20 years of stories of Darth Vader.
Well, yeah, and that's
wreaking havoc that we could do.
There's that whole period between 3 and 4.
Yeah.
That they could fill in.
They could.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that.
Well, you just like Star Wars. You're just like a Star Wars nut.
I'm a dork.
Yeah.
Well, so, overall, the movie was good. I give it. Woody Harrelson was really good in it. Newton is really good in it.
Woody Harrelson, as an actor now...
He's having a great later-in-life career.
Yeah, a great later-in-life career, but I see him as Woody Harrelson. You understand what I'm saying?
No, I do.
I just don't see him as a character... In a movie, I see him as Woody Harrelson. It's like when, and I'm just watching Guardians of the Galaxies again, number 2, and it's not a spoiler, but Sylvester Stallone is in it.
Ugh.
And I'm like, why?
Why?
You could have found someone else, and he is Sylvester Stallone. He's Rocky, he's Rambo, he's... You know what I'm saying? It's Sylvester Stallone, and I'm like, you've just totally taken me out of the entire movie. It was kind of hard to suspend belief that this could be taking place in another galaxy and with all these creatures, and there's Rocky. You know, it just blew it. There's been other movies like that. I can't think of them right away. You know which one blew it for me?
What?
Another one. I was enjoying Lincoln. And
the Daniel Day-Lewis Lincoln movie?
Yes.
Okay.
And towards the end, all of a sudden,
Bruce
here
Willis
comes...
Who?
Not Bruce Willis.
Who ruins Lincoln?
I forgot
for
who the actor is, but It was the act.
Suddenly, Christopher Walken's there, and he says,
he comes dancing in.
Hey, Lincoln, I don't know.
I think it needs more cowbell,
Mr. Lincoln. I saw a great interview with Dave Grohl. You know the band, the Foo Fighters?
Yeah.
So Dave Grohl, who's the lead singer and guitarist in the Foo Fighters, he was the drummer in Nirvana, and he seems like a really good guy. I've never met him. I've never heard a lot of interviews with him, but for some reason, I see something somebody posted about Dave Grohl, and there's an interview he's doing with another member of the Foo Fighters, with somebody overseas, maybe BBC, something like that.
Right.
And they're asking him about, because I think Dave Grohl does imitations.
Oh.
And so they're asking him about the time they were on Saturday Night Live and Christopher Walken was headlining. And he said that he tells this great story about Christopher Walken coming up to them and he's saying, "Is the emphasis on Foo or Fighters?" And Dave, to mess with him, says, because everybody says Foo Fighters.
Right.
He says, "It's on Fighters." He says, "Okay, okay." And so he says, before they go on, he's just Christopher Walken. He goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, Foo Fighters." But Grohl does this like dead on perfect. I mean, it's good. This Walken imitation. "Ladies and gentlemen, Foo Fighters." And it just sounds so perfect.
Hilarious.
So I could see Christopher Walken suddenly, "Mr. Lincoln." You know, I could see that like he'd be in a little out of place. Who was it?
Let me look it up. Let me look up the characters.
Paul Bettany.
No.
Paul Bettany is in Solo. A really good character. Really cool character. And sometimes they introduce these great characters, and I don't know if they just don't realize when they're filming it that we need more of that character.
Oh, Tommy Lee Jones.
I can see that.
At the end of the movie, he's like one of the...
Although, what a perfect movie for him to be in, because the man never smiles.
Yeah. He plays...
He's the guy at the end that says, "Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like to play?" Right? Isn't that the last scene?
No, that's not
I thought that's how it ends. 312-981-7200. Quick break, and then the news coming up, and then, did somebody finally figure out once and for all D.B. Cooper? We'll talk about that after the news next, 720 WGN. 4:01 in the morning, we'll get to the news in a second. Roger, you have some breaking news.
You're aware of Necco Wafers?
Yes.
Okay, and remember the story?
They were going to go bankrupt. They were begging for help.
They were looking for a seller.
People don't want them to go under because what else are you going to sneak into the tolls when you're out of change?
Right, and people were afraid not only the Necco wafers, but they made the little candy hearts.
The
little Valentine. Yeah, they did that also.
I don't mean to sound terrible.
Mm-hmm.
The world is better off without this company.
No.
Two most atrocious candies in the world.
They're so good.
I don't know how they survived as long as they did.
Well, they found a buyer, and the products will continue. I knew the world was waiting for that announcement.
For Necco wafers and the chalky candy hearts they used to give out that just taste horrible.
The little box of hearts, yeah. Love those. My teeth love them. My dentist loved them. And I like the chocolate Necco wafers. All right, more important things.
We solve D.B. Cooper next. You can win a 2018 Chevy Silverado. For details, listen to Steve Cochran. Weekday mornings at 720 on 720 WGN Chicago. If you're a smart speaker user, just say play WGN Radio and tune in. The news is sponsored, Roger. Who is it sponsored by?
Ishnala
Supper Club and the Old Fashioned Brandy. Or the Brandy Old Fashioned.
Brandy Old Fashioned.
Still working on it. Hey, we got them sponsor news. We're getting closer.
Look at this.
A little bit after 4 in the morning, I'm going to go urban exploring. Roger, do the news. It's always a good time. Good morning and good night. I wake up at twilight. It's going to be all right. We don't even have to try. It's always a good time. Matt Bobala with you here, 720 WGN, 4:12 in the morning, everybody. Thank you so much for staying up even later with us, or maybe getting up nice and early and turning us on right away. We're in the historic Tribune Tower building in our Allstate Showcase studio for a few more weeks before we move south of the river. I'm Matt Bubala with you here until 5 in the morning. Orion Samuelson will be along with the morning show then. So if you've been listening to the show over the years I've been here, you know that I am fascinated by D.B. Cooper, the mysterious hijacker who, in 1971, hijacked a Northwest Airlines plane. It's a Boeing 727. That's the type that used to have the back door exit. The little staircase folded down and you could walk out the back, as I did on my honeymoon in Jamaica. But D.B. Cooper had a ransom note, gave it to a flight attendant who thought it was just a dude hitting on her. So she put it away and he's like, "Hey, you better read that." Said, "I have a bomb." He had wires in a bag, looked like a bomb. They get money. They land. They get money. They let everybody else off the plane except for the crew. They take back off. Tells the crew to all get in the cockpit. The back door opens. Suddenly, D.B. Cooper is gone. And we have never found him. Found some of the money years later, like on a beach in a riverbed. But that's it. We've spoken with Thomas Colbert, who's written a book that says that a man named Robert Rackstraw, who lives in San Diego, is D.B. Cooper. And they are convinced that that is D.B. Cooper. Now another theory has come out. Michigan publisher Principia Media is coming out with a book that says that the hijacker was a former military paratrooper and intelligence operative, Walter R. Recca. The CEO of Principia Media, Vern Jones, joins us on the phone right now. Good morning, Vern. How are you doing?
Good morning.
Thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. So this is literally completely brand new information. This isn't a guy, I believe, that was, you know, the other guy, Rackstraw, that the person we've interviewed says is the guy. He's been interviewed by the FBI. The FBI had said, no, that wasn't him years ago. This gentleman, who we're now saying in the new book, D.B. Cooper and Me, A Criminal, A Spy, My Best Friend, written by the gentleman's name is Carl Lauren, who was Walter Recca's friend, says that he was D.B. Cooper. Is this somebody that the FBI has ever even looked into?
No. Well, that's amazing, too, because the FBI, their first suspects were often parachutists, skydivers. And Walter probably had more skydives than anybody in the Northwest at that time. He had literally hundreds of jumps, and many of them in the military, a lot of them recreational in Michigan. But he was one of the people that, for whatever reason, they didn't interview him. The guy that came to pick him up after the jump, he called his friend. He was interviewed. He was also a fire jumper. But for whatever reason, Walter was never on the radar.
So what is the motivation? Why Walter Recca? Let me ask you. So he lived in the Pacific Northwest at the time?
Yes, he did. He lived in Heartland, Heartland, Washington.
Okay. And what was the motivation for the hijacking at the time? Was he in financial distress? Why did he do it?
Yes, he was tired of being poor, was what his what he told his niece. He said, I'd rather be dead than poor. And so it was purely money.
Okay. He escapes the plane. Did he keep all the money? Because some of the money was later found, years later. Did he make off with most of the money?
Well, he landed with all the money. When he made his way to a small cafe, when he was the last few hundred feet of his jump, he saw a light, and he kind of walked towards where that light was. It actually was a cafe that was open until midnight. And so he walked to that place. He called his friend. He asked for directions from the only other customer in the cafe at that time, a guy he called the cowboy because he wore cowboy attire and he had a guitar next to him. So he asked Cowboy to tell his friend Don where he was, and then to come and get him. And when Don did stop, he was driving him back to Heartland. He gave, Walter's words, a few bundles of the money and gave them to him and said, now you're wearing this together. But the rest of the money, he went into Canada and put it in a safe deposit box, but he spent a fair amount. He bought a house, he bought a car, and he bought some furniture.
Wasn't the money marked? Wouldn't they have known if that money was being passed around?
Well, that was a good question. We checked it out with bankers in the 70s, and of course there were no computers whatsoever. There was merely a list of all the serial numbers on pages, all these pages, just, and they weren't even in chronological order. The idea that that banks would automatically check every $20 bill coming in was ridiculous.
Sure, but wouldn't the government know? Doesn't the government know if that money has been circulated? Couldn't they check and find out if that money was passed around for years?
Well, they don't. You know, when they, again, I'm going back to the bankers, and we talked to them how they get rid of money. All the bills were actually 2 to 3 years old already, that he got them. And it's pretty common for $20 bills to last anywhere from 4 to 5 years in circulation. Mm-hmm. When they take them out of circulation, that goes back to the Federal Reserve, they don't check serial numbers. All they look for is counterfeit, and then they destroy them. And they don't record the serial numbers when they do it.
Hmm. Interesting. So how did he know that he could pull it off, I guess? And how much detail were they able to get? Because Walter Recca has passed away, right? How many years ago did he die?
He died in 2014.
He died so almost 4 years ago. And
right.
his friend who wrote the book for you guys, mm-hmm. he knew that he was D.B. Cooper. How did he figure this out? And was Recca making a deathbed confession? How did this happen?
Yeah. It wasn't really a deathbed confession. That was kind of what some reporters are saying, but it really wasn't. I mean, he had conversations. Carl lives in Florida, and Walter at that time in his life lived in northeastern Michigan. And they would call. They were friends. They started one of the very first skydiving clubs in the country in the 50s. And so it ended up to be 9 of them, but it started out with just 4 of them, and Walt was one of them, as was Carl. So they started skydiving well back every weekend in Michigan, even in the winters. And so they would put on air shows. People would come to this small airport, and they'd pass a hat back in the 50s. Finally, in the 60s, it all kind of broke up, and then Walt went out to Washington State. And that was where he lived. But as soon as the jump hit, Carl turned to his wife, Loretta, and said, can you believe what Walter just did? And one of their other friends called Carl and said the same thing. So they kind of suspect him because it was something that Walter had talked about when they were sitting around drinking after they would jump. And he kept saying, I think the best crime would be one where you just rob an airplane, is the way he said it. So it was something he had talked about way back then. But this group of parachuters, they finally started getting back together in 1998, again in northern Michigan. And they would spend weekends together and just talk about their stories. And Carl was the one who would always record the stories. He started writing them down. And then the next year, they called it a billabog. The next year he'd come back and Carl would pass out the stories. Well, Carl suspected that it was Walt because Walt had disappeared for quite some time. Carl calls this his dark years because he didn't contact his family and he was traveling overseas a lot. And, so he, started saying, Walt, you were Cooper, right? And Walt just wouldn't acknowledge him at all. And then finally, in 2008, was when Walt finally said to Carl, yes, I am Cooper. It was strange. They would have these conversations for years, and they would, starting in 2000, Walt would just start telling him about his overseas adventures and some of the things that he did over there. But then he would talk a little bit about the Cooper thing without actually saying it. But finally, in 2008, he admitted to Carl, and from that time on, they were talking a lot. Carl recorded 3.5 hours of the conversations, talking about the jump and leading up to the jump and how he, all the details of how he got to Portland and everything. So that's 3.5 hours of recorded conversation. Much of them are described in the book.
I haven't been able to read the book yet, but I have just the press Sure. releases about it and stuff. And it mentions that maybe one of the reasons this crime was never solved was because the FBI didn't want to solve it, that this man maybe became an FBI operative or an agent or something after the hijacking.
Yeah, it was, he talked with, again, that's on the recordings too. He and Carl spoke of what he did. In 1962, Walter went out to California to Elsinore, to their drop zone out there, and because he had heard that if you start skydiving out there, the CIA often recruits people from there. So he went out there and he met this guy. His name is, we have his name, but we don't know if he's still alive or not. So we just call him Philip few. And Philip kind of ushered him through this whole process so that he could apply to the CIA. Walter was raised in a family that spoke Russian and Polish. And as a matter of fact, he spoke those two languages before he even spoke English. And so he thought with that backdrop or the background, he was a paratrooper in the military. He was fighting quite a bit. He thought he'd get in with the CIA. But in 63, we have the rejection letter where the CIA said, we aren't going to be able to utilize your skills at this time. But he kept in contact with this Phil Q. And in 1971, in January, Phil got him a job at a company called Vanel Corporation in Seattle. Vanel has close ties to the intelligence community. It's pretty well known. So it's very well documented. Even with interviews with their officials, they admit to being in that business. So he started working there in January of 71. And then, of course, it was November of 71 that they did the hijacking. And then from that point on, two months after the hijacking, he was working at the, he was doing iron work at the Grand Coulee Dam. And about 2 months after the hijacking, two guys came up to him at work and said, you know, hey, well, let's go have a drink after work. So they went to a place called the Brown Derby in Spokane. And as Walt described it, he said that the two guys came in and they sat down and they ordered a beer, and the waitress brought the beer to them and set in front of them. He said, after the waitress left, the one guy looked at him and said, Walter, I said, Walter Pica, which is bizarre because he was going under the name Recca at the time. He was born Walter Pica, but he was going under an assumed name, which he used for the rest of his life, as Walter Recca. And he finally had it changed about 6 years after that. But they said, Walter Pica, do you want to go to prison? And Walter said, no. And then the other gentleman said, then you work for us. And they stood up and left the bar. And he never saw him again. But from that point on, he went through a training. Someone called and gave him, said, there's an airline ticket for you to get on it. And so he started traveling around the country doing these training near college towns, you know, said, primarily in Boise. And 1974, he got his very first passport under the name Walter Recca, and again, that assumed name. And so he had an eighth grade education. He was a mediocre welder at best. But from that point on, he traveled all over the world, Indonesia, into the behind the Iron Curtain, into Poland. We have his passports. We have diaries. So that part of his life is very well documented.
Well, what does the FBI say about all of this? I'm sorry, I'm running out of time, so I want to get to some meat here. But have you taken this to the FBI? Is the FBI not going to say anything because it's a cover-up on their part and they don't want the true nature or true identity of D.B. Cooper revealed?
Yeah, well, the answer to the question is no, we did not go to the FBI. Walter's niece, actually, Walter wrote a confession, and he also confessed to his niece. And his niece lives in Vegas, and so she had a friend who was a FBI, retired FBI. And so she gave that confession to them. And according to his niece, the FBI agent came back and said, they won't even take it. I can't believe that they won't even look into it. But the FBI has been very clear. They said that the only thing that they would accept as evidence is one of the $20 bills or the parachute. Obviously, that's really limiting your scope of your investigation. Yeah. But they're aware of this, but we haven't had any response from them directly at all. But they've closed the case, as you know.
Sure, but they did say, you know, with new evidence, we would look back into it. Did he still have any of the money at all?
No, he didn't. He didn't. He ended up transferring the money once he started traveling and working with the. He didn't. He said it wasn't when Carl would say, "Did you work for the CIA?" He would immediately say, "No." He called Carl Charlie. He said, no, Charlie, it's not the CIA. It's not just one of them. I work for all of them. And he just kept repeating that phrase, and we're thinking that it also meant, I know that he talked about working for the Israelis at one point. He had a KGB passport, as a matter of fact. I'm sorry, not a passport. It was an identification. So he had passports from England and the United States, but so it's, I don't think I'm not sure it was the FBI. I don't know who interfered with the investigation, but we don't have any direct evidence of that. But Walt was very careful to say it's not just one of them. I work for all.
Well, Vern, we only have a moment left, but what's your level of belief in this? Because it sounds like this man confessed and said he did all these things, but we don't have that one piece of evidence that says, look, this really was him, do we?
No, we don't. The only evidence we have are the long underwear that he wore, and he gave those to Carl. But what we do have, obviously, are the conversations, 3.5 hours of conversation with Kate. We have a witness that saw him after the jump, that met him, the cowboy that he met in the bar. We found him, and he literally recalls the encounter. He was former police officer. And then we have his confession to his niece and his sister.
What about the friend who picked him up, who he gave supposedly a bundle of money to?
Yes, he passed away. I think he passed, I could look at it, but I think it was well before Walter passed away, Don died.
The book is out now, right? It's available now?
It is.
D.B. Yes. Cooper and Me, A Criminal, A Spy, My Best Friend by Walter Recca's friend Carl Lauren, available from Principal Media now. Vern Jones is the CEO of Principal Media. We appreciate you jumping on the phone and curious to see where this heads, and we'll be looking forward to reading the book. Thanks so much for jumping on the phone.
You bet. Thanks for your time, man.
You bet, Vern. Okay, again, the book is D.B. Cooper and Me, A Criminal, A Spy, My Best Friend. We'll see where that heads next. Quick break, then the news, 720 WGN. Matt Pubala with you, 720 WGN. Off from my home. We're flying up no ceiling when we in our zone. Roger says bad ozone today.
Yep.
What does that mean? Is that bad breath for us or bad breath? Bad breath. It's ozone action alert, Pete. Get your Mentos on, because you're going to be knocking some people out with that breath today, people. Whew. You get that ozone in the air, and you
stand
just stink
down
it up.
Wind, baby.
Yeah, don't be breathing too hard on people with that ozone. Does that mean bad breathing for us, or does it mean we're going to burn more easily? Because the hole in the ozone layer,
contributing
to skincare.
I know. Yeah.
But that's how I equate ozone. When I hear about ozone, I think of the ozone layer. The hole in the ozone layer means more people are getting skin cancer.
No, what's happening is there's an upper air system that is holding our air in the lower level. So a lot of the air that usually the bad air, fumes and stuff that usually get cleared out by winds or circulation into the upper atmosphere is holding the air in, and it's just kind of with the heavy heat, with the heat coming in today and tomorrow, and really not much movement of air. The winds are going to be extremely light over the next couple of days, so it's going to allow the stagnant air to accumulate, and it's going to make it harder to breathe, which means people who have respiratory issues or even heart issues need to take it slow over to at least today, maybe tomorrow. We won't know more about tomorrow until later today.
Okay, that's good to know. Earlier this week, I was headed north on Lakeshore Drive, and I saw a layer of smog over the city as I looked north. And I hadn't seen that in a long time. Now, maybe I'm not over the lake enough and seeing that. Maybe that's pretty regular. But I was surprised and saddened by that, thinking about that.
Well, and I don't think it's... I don't want to get into a discussion about global climate change or anything like that. But you're dealing with a large metropolitan area. This happens in Los Angeles. It happens in San Francisco. It happens in Las Vegas, actually, for someone who lived there and for a number of years. It happens there.
I imagine just most when major metropolitan areas it happens.
Especially around where you have a lot of cars and industry.
Yeah.
And those fumes can only rise so high up. And usually when you have a front come through, which usually brings storms, that front will force the air to move. You have a lot of heavy winds, but we're not seeing heavy winds being predicted over the next couple of days.
Yeah.
And when that happens, the air just kind of settles.
All right, so I'm going to take a quick break. 312-981-7200 is the number. You can call or text. I went to the dog beach this week.
Woohoo!
First time I've ever been there.
Who took you? Oh, I'm sorry. No.
Possibly the last time I will ever go.
What?
I will tell you why next. 720 WGN. Thank you, everybody. Matt Bavala, 720 WGN, 15 minutes till the morning show with Orion Samuelson coming up. I was teasing before the break there that I went to the dog beach this week, Montrose Dog Beach. We have a section of the beach at Montrose Harbor that is sectioned off for dogs.
Right.
Blocked by a fence on one side from the rest of the public beach,
mm-hmm.
and then sort of has fence around it, although erosion on the beach. There's supposed to be an entrance that you get into the dog beach from.
Right.
You go through a fence, through another fence, down a ramp, through a way. Well, we were there on Wednesday, there was flooding, which meant you really couldn't go in the normal way.
Right.
But the fence in the back that blocks it off, there's been so much erosion that the fence sticks out of the sand about a foot and a half. So you just step over the fence.
Oh. Wow.
So we went there to shoot some video with Steve Dale for one of our sponsors. We mm-hmm. wanted to test out some dog treats on dogs and things like that. So it was an adventure. First of all, let me just say, I had just been bragging to a friend the week before mm-hmm. about how long it's been since I've gagged smelling dog poop. I have a not good gag reflex, Roger.
Ooh.
It's amazing to me. I throw up at the smell of things. I throw up at the sight of things.
That's not good.
Since I had kids, somehow,
mm-hmm.
kids are different. It's your own blood. There's something in it that when your kids throw up, when your kids poop, you can clean that up. And you don't end up gagging and throwing up. Okay. I don't know how, but you get through it.
Well, maybe you're focused on their health.
Must be.
And
don't know.
That's a secondary. Okay.
And with Bailey, our little puppy that we've had for 7 months now,
mm-hmm.
When he poops, I can pick it up. I don't like the smell, but I can handle it.
Right.
We get to the dog beach. And very early on, I was questioning humanity. We get in, we go over the fence, we start setting up. Dogs are running around unleashed, which I guess is kind of what you do at the dog beach. But there seemed to be very little supervision. We start videotaping Steve. One huge dog, like a 150-pound dog.
Mm.
Comes trotting over by the fence by us, a few feet away from Steve.
Let's see what's going on.
And he decides that that's the place to just let his insides come Ooh. Completely out of his body. I mean, a pile of wet mess like Ugh. You haven't seen. And the wind is blowing in our face. And I know it's bad when Jim, my business partner, who's running the camera, turns and goes, that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
So now I know I'm in trouble
because mm-hmm.
I got the sight of it and now I'm smelling it and immediately I'm like,
uh-oh.
And I'm trying to gain my composure. I'm pulling my shirt over my nose. I'm trying to keep it together.
Right.
And I finally have to just walk away. Can't be here.
Jeez.
So I head off back over the fence up into the grassy area. Jim trains the camera on me to catch me throwing up, which I do eventually do because it's
oh,
so bad.
No.
Steve Dale asks for a bag and cleans it up somehow.
Wait, where was the owner?
Who knows? It's the Wild West at this place.
Oh, my God.
I don't know where the owner is. That dog's marching around. Dogs are taking craps everywhere on the beach. People aren't cleaning it up. It's insanity. Insanity.
Wow.
We're taping a little while longer, so we do a bunch of stuff. And then we had a bunch of props out there. I'm starting to put them away. And then Jim's doing a few more stand-up things with Steve.
Mm-hmm.
While I'm putting stuff away, I hear this ruckus with a bunch of dogs. I look over. There are some dogs attacking another dog on the dog beach.
Oh, no.
And it looks like two dogs kind of fighting at first. And then like eight other dogs jump in on this. It's like a melee of dogs. And you hear one dog like getting attacked.
Yeah.
And I see people congregating over trying to break it up. One guy who we had met there comes in and starts throwing haymaker punches at one of the dogs.
What?
I guess to get him off the other dog. I'm looking at this like, where the hell am I? This is not real. He's like throwing huge punches at this dog. And then they're by the water. Somebody's splashing water on the dogs. Finally, they get them separated. And I think life is going back to normal. And none of these people are, I mean, there's no dogs on leash, which I guess you don't do. It's the dog beach, whatever. I would never in a million years take my dog to this place.
Never.
Never.
I don't even know why. Never mind. I know why.
And it's a great place to have if human beings weren't involved. Because people don't take care of things the way they should. They don't. They're not cleaning up the poop. They're not keeping an eye on their dog.
And I bet you there's a sign or several signs that say, clean up after your dog.
There's garbage cans everywhere.
Yeah.
I believe there's stands with bags. I mean, it could be done. Human beings would know to bring the bags with, to keep an eye on them. All these things. But they don't.
And this,
they don't care.
This jumps back to your earlier conversation about how mankind supposedly has the wherewithal over the animal kingdom to be able to make these decisions.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
So, now I'm cleaning up again. I think this is over. I'm putting stuff away.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear some yelling and screaming. So now I turn around again. Now there's two guys, nose to nose, screaming at each other, calling each other names.
Oh, jeez.
The one dude headbutts the other guy. And now they start wrestling and falling on the ground. And I'm standing by the trunk of the car going, I can't believe this is my life right now. Jim, the cameraman, I see walk over to the fight. So now I'm like, oh, great. Now we're getting involved in this. So now I'm like, well, if he's going, I better get over there. So I get over there. And Jim is the voice of reason. He's the one guy's on top of the other guy now. He tells him, hey, don't do anymore. You know you're going to end up in jail. Just let this go. Let this go. Walk away. Blah, blah. So he calms him down. He lets the guy back up. The guy who was down on the ground, who the other guy had down on the ground,
right,
now starts calling that guy names again.
Oh.
After he lets him up. Jim talks to the other guy into just walking away, letting it go, separates them. We pack up. We're finally ready to leave.
Man.
And I'm just like, oh my gosh. And Steve and I had a debate about this earlier this week. I'm like, Steve, there need to be people at the dog beach. We hire lifeguards for the human beach. There needs to be. He's like, well, you're not going to get lifeguards. I'm like, I know you're not going to get lifeguards. He's like, well, it's volunteer. There's no money for that. I'm like, the park district should be paying for something, a security guard, something to keep an eye on the people. Because people are no good. I've lost faith in humanity, Raj.
Is there any pizza left?
There's a couple slices. Jess will bring them up to you. All right, quick break. We'll say hi to Orion next, 720 WGN. Again, to see, I did a little urban exploring during the newscast tonight. I've got some pictures of a gutted out floor of the Tribune Tower on my Facebook page. Like our Facebook page, The Matt Bubala Show on Facebook, when you get a chance, and you can see the photos there. One more quick break. Say hello to Orion Samuelson in the morning show next, 720 WGN. That's all we have for The Matt Bubala Show today. I will be off next weekend, but back the following week, possibly for my final show ever here in the Showcase Studio before we make the big move. Saying hello this morning now to Orion Samuelson. Hey, Big O.
Well, good morning to you, and it sounds like you're attending people fights and dog fights going into the Memorial Day weekend.
It was a heck of a start to the week, O.
It sure was.
I hope you've had a calmer one.